Let us continue. Remember, this was the overall schedule that we are following now. And we, the end of the last lecture, arrived here, where we have the Hamiltonian formalism of quantum field theory, fully covariant, but we haven't quantized it yet. And so that's where we are now, and we will quantize the theory today. What does it mean to quantize a field theory? Remember, there are three things that need to be done. We need to implement the canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity conditions, and the equations of motion. Now, the canonical commutation relations are going to be, as they were for Minkowski space, also on curved space-time, that the equal time commutator of the field and the canonically conjugate momentum field is IH bar times the Dirac delta. Only that now the canonically conjugate momentum field is, of course, much more complicated than just the time derivative of phi. And still, the fields commute at space-like separation, which is to say, at equal time, the field commutes with itself. And also, the canonically conjugate momentum fields commute at equal time, that is to say, at space-like separation. Remember that whenever two events are space-like separated, you can choose a coordinate system such that they are at equal time. So we need to implement these canonical commutation relations, and we need to implement the hermeticity condition. So far, we dealt with a Klein-Gordon field that was real valued. It was just number valued, and those numbers were real. But after the quantization, we can only require the expectation values to be real. And that means that our operators have to be Hermitian. So we require that phi dagger is phi and pi dagger is pi. I will abbreviate the canonical commutation relations as CCRs and the hermeticity conditions as HC. And then we also have to solve the equations of motion. In the Heisenberg picture, the equations of motion are formally unchanged. They're still simply that the time derivative of any observable is equal to 1 over IH bar, and then the commutator of the observable with H. You usually see that with the IH bar on the other side. But I think it makes sense to put it in here to remind ourselves from about where this is coming from. Because ultimately, what we're really writing down here is that the time derivative of an observable is the Poisson bracket between the observable and the Hamiltonian. And that Poisson bracket in quantum mechanics can be represented as 1 over IH bar times the commutator. Right? If you're not so familiar with these things, please read up on my lecture notes on quantum theory of last term. It's all on my web pages. So the fact that ultimately this is just saying that the time derivative of an observable is the Poisson bracket of that observable with the Hamiltonian guarantees that we get equations of motion that are formally the same in classical as in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, in the Heisenberg picture, that is, where our observables are time dependent. And notice that this equation holds true even in the fully covariant quantum theory. But what does it boil down to? Well, when we write down this equation of motion here for the field and its canonically conjugate field, and what do we obtain? Well, then we obtain the Klein-Gordon equation with all of its complications because of curvature. And we obtain the relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum field and the derivatives of the field. How do we know that this gives us that? But remember when we studied the Legendre transform, we made sure that we were keeping track of how the equations of motion on the Lagrangian side imply and are implied by the equations of motion on the Hamiltonian side. So no matter how complicated these things were, just the properties of the Legendre transform guaranteed that the one set of equations of motion was transformed into the other set. We don't have to do that again. It's covered by what we did, that these commutation relations boil down to that equation of motion.
Question. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have an equation that involves the time derivatives of the pi's? I mean, I guess we don't need it, but...
No, it's basically in here. It's just that I did a bit of a shortcut here in not expressing the time derivatives of phi. You see, in principle, since we are working in the Hamiltonian framework, there should only be two variables occurring, phi and pi. When I say that phi can occur, I'm also allowing the space derivatives of phi. But the time derivative of phi should not occur. If we do the Hamiltonian framework cleanly, the time derivatives of phi have to be expressed in terms of pi and phi. Right? Because the Legendre pair of the Legendre transform was the time derivative for phi and pi. And it's just convenient to write the Klein-Gordon equation this way. But if we wanted to be 100% on the Hamiltonian side, we would have to identify in here the time derivatives of phi. And there are time derivatives of phi because of this. And then these time derivatives can be expressed in terms of the canonically conjugate momentum field, namely by solving that equation. You see, this equation has space derivatives and time derivatives of phi. We can isolate the time derivative here and then express it in terms of the canonically conjugate momentum field and the space derivatives that we shuffle on the other side. So in this way, the Klein-Gordon equation can be expressed in such a way that it only contains phi, space derivatives of phi, and pi. It just makes it messy. And so I expressed it only in terms of phi. But if you do express it in terms of pi, you find that there are time derivatives of pi in there. Just because the first time derivative is going to give you, first time derivative here on phi is going to give you pi, but then there's another time derivative waiting over there. So these are the things that we have to solve. The equations of motion, the hermeticity conditions, and the canonical commutation relation. What we need is a field phi hat of x and t, and a canonically conjugate field pi hat of x and t that obeys all these three conditions. Then we can say we've solved the quantum field theory for curved spacetime. Now let's remember what the solution looked like in Minkowski space, because maybe that gives us a hint as to how we might solve that problem in curved spacetime. In the case of Minkowski space, that's what we found. We found that the field can be expressed as an integral over d3k. And then we had here so-called mode functions. This is just number-valued functions, plane waves, really. Plane waves multiplying the annihilation and creation operators. And there was the prefactor here. And we had that pi was just phi dot. Now let's analyze the structure of that solution here. Why does it obey the hermeticity conditions, the equations of motion, and the canonical commutation relation? Well, first, let's check the hermeticity condition. Is phi of x and t obviously Hermitian, given that it's in this form? Well, the answer is yes, because these things are real. And that is the Hermitian conjugate of this. So therefore, if you take the overall Hermitian conjugate, the sheer fact that we sum two terms that are the Hermitian conjugate of each other guarantees that the whole thing is Hermitian. So that tells us that if we want to solve the full problem for curved space-time, we may want to try something like this. We write down something here plus the Hermitian conjugate of it, and then we no longer need to worry about solving the Hermiticity conditions. It's going to be guaranteed. Now, how about the equations of motion? Klein-Gordon equation. Why is it that this thing is obeying the Klein-Gordon equation, given that it has this form? Well, let's see. As far as the Klein-Gordon equation is concerned, a partial differential equation, as far as the Klein-Gordon equation is concerned, the A and A dagger operators don't matter. Because even though they are complicated in the sense that they would be represented as operators or matrices, they don't actually have any time or space dependence. So they might as well just be numbers for the purpose of solving the Klein-Gordon equation. And constant numbers at that. No, what matters for the Klein-Gordon equation is only the space and time dependence, because it involves space and time derivative. Here again, none of this, no space, no time dependence in here. But these guys have space and time dependence. And if you look at them, you will see that it's exactly the space and time dependence that's demanded by the Klein-Gordon equation of Minkowski space. Second time derivative applied to the field plus second space derivative applied to the field should be zero. And that's what we get. Right? Second derivative here, and then second derivative there. We get down an omega squared. We get down a k squared or k vector squared. And so, yes, we get the Klein-Gordon equation. So another lesson we can learn from this is that if we want to solve the quantum field theoretical problem for curved space-time, we may want to adopt a strategy where we again separate out the different tasks. We say that we solve the Klein-Gordon equation disregarding any issues of non-commutativity by saying we make an ansatz where we have a function here that's number-valued and that has a space-time dependence whose only purpose is to fulfill the Klein-Gordon equation. And then we multiply that with an operator that later will be needed for the canonical commutation relations. But as far as the space and time derivatives of the Klein-Gordon D'Alembert operator are concerned, that's just a constant, so it will not interfere with our quest to fulfill the Klein-Gordon equation. So what we have so far is we have the strategy that we fulfill the hermeticity condition by writing down in our attempt at solving the full problem something here plus the Hermitian conjugate of it that will make the whole thing Hermitian. Secondly, that something should be a number-valued function that will be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, multiplying some operator that we will later need to also fulfill the canonical commutation relations, but that should not carry any space or time dependence. We pack all of that into here. Now, there are many solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and we will have to find out which ones to choose. Maria?
Could we not keep the time dependence, though, in the AKs and the AK daggers? Because after all, they are defined in terms of IK and pi k of t.
Absolutely, we could, and some authors do that. I think it's just conceptually easier to separate these tasks, because we have three different tasks to do. So I'm just writing it as a product in this case. But later on, yes, if you want to, you can absorb the time dependence, for example, in the AK of x. So then you get that there's just a Fourier factor in space, and the AK become time dependent. So some authors will shuffle some or all of the space-time dependence into the AKs. But ultimately, you can separate the matrix character from the time, space and time dependence. And just for clarity of the derivation, I'm separating them completely so that we have a number-valued function that takes care of the Klein-Gordon equation, and an operator-valued constant, which will take care of the canonical commutation relations. And then later it might be convenient to absorb some of that in here. Just for notation purposes, it might be efficient to give these things time dependent. Okay, but so far we've only taken care of the hermeticity condition and the equations of motion. There is still the small matter of getting the canonical commutation relations to be obeyed as well. And that is a rather significant condition. Imagine we would not have to do that. Then in that case, well, these guys would not even have to have, they would not need to be operators at all, right? They only need to be operators in order to obey the canonical commutation relations. But more than that, what's the deal with the integral? Why do we need an integral? After all, it would seem we can just pick a solution here. And here these A and A dagger operators, by writing it in this form, we have the hermeticity condition for free. We have the equations of motion for free, assuming that this is the solution of the equations of motion. And then with these AK and AK daggers, don't we just get the canonical commutation relations too, and we're done? Why that integral? But it turns out it's not sufficient to just choose one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. It's not sufficient for the canonical commutation relations. In order to actually get the phi to obey the canonical commutation relations, we need lots of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation and sum them all up with the right coefficients that change with k. Then only can we get a solution also to the canonical commutation relations. Secondly, what are we doing with this? We need a solution not just for phi, we need also that pi does the right thing. Now that is a secondary problem. Once we have the phi field, in Minkowski space, we were simply able to define the pi field as its time derivative. Now in, in the case of curved spacetime, we can do something similar. We know what the relationship should be between the pi and the phi, that is to say between the time derivative, the space derivatives of phi and pi. And so we simply define the pi to obey that condition that we derived covariantly. So that's the pi whose commutation relations with phi have to be the correct ones. Okay, so that's going to be the strategy. We get hermeticity from choosing this to be the Hermitian conjugate of that. We get the equations of motion by always making sure that whatever function we put in here is going to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And then for the canonical commutation relations, we have to be prepared that we have to use lots of solutions, lots of these operators, and sum them up in order to get the canonical commutation relations. There's one more curious thing that we can read off from this solution of the problem in Minkowski space. Remember that our Klein-Gordon equation is simply D'Alembertian minus m squared applied to phi is equal to 0, or without a mass. And our phi field is a real valued field. And when we quantize, it's going to be a Hermitian valued field. But in spite of that, this equation, this solution shows us that what we need here is not a real valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. This is a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay? So that's what we should expect as well for quantum fields on generic curved spacetimes. Even though the classical field theory is a theory for just real valued fields, let's obey the Klein-Gordon equation. And even though the quantum field theory is going to be a quantum field theory for Hermitian valued, operator valued fields, phi hat of x and t, these so-called mode functions, whose purpose it is to make sure that this Hermitian thing obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, this thing actually has to be complex. We don't see at the moment why it has to be complex. Because if this was chosen to be real, for example, the cosine of the argument or the sine of the argument, we would still have the hermeticity condition obeyed. We would still have the equations of motion obeyed. But it turns out it's again the canonical commutation relations. Cannot be had. They cannot be fulfilled if you choose those guys real. You will find that generally they always have to be complex valued. That's curious in a way, because the Klein-Gordon equation that we want to quantize is for real valued fields or Hermitian valued fields. But in the process of solving it, part of the solution involves complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. All right, so with this preparation, then let's make an ansatz. So let's try out something to solve the problem. So inspired by the form of the solution for Minkowski space, let us write down that the field is a linear combination of this kind. It's just an ansatz. We're just guessing the shape of the solution. So we're writing the field as a sum here, which replaces that integral. And it could be an integral. It could be a sum. Let's be open-minded about it. So when I write the sum here, I might as well have written an integral. But it could be both. It could be a mix of them. Doesn't really matter. Further, the k doesn't have to be a momentum at all. In fact, on a generic curved space-time, there's no such thing as a three momentum. How would you define that? There's no canonical covariant way of doing that. No, the k is just going to be a label. It could be a multi-label, just like here. These k, these momenta, are three-component vectors. This could be a three-component thing. It could also have 27 components. Let's be open-minded about that. We're just saying it's the sum over possibly lots of terms of this form. Something plus the Hermitian conjugate of it. So by doing this, we are making sure that whatever we do, this thing is going to be Hermitian. Okay? Just by making sure that this is the Hermitian conjugate of that. Second, we choose these to be number valued. The UK and the UK stars, the mode functions, are going to be number valued. And the A and A dagger are going to be just the usual A and A dagger. I mean, they're going to have the usual commutation relations. Commutator of AK with AK dagger is Kronecker delta of K and K prime. Kronecker delta or Dirac delta, depending on whether this is a sum or an integral. So these are going to be our generalized mode functions. And we anticipate already that they're generally going to be complex valued. Just because even in Minkowski space, they're complex valued. So there's no reason to expect that in generic curved space-time, they wouldn't be complex valued. But more than that, we can't choose them arbitrarily. No. In order to achieve our goal, we have to choose them to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. In other words, K labels choices of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Also up here, you know, K, for every three momentum, we get another solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. The Klein-Gordon equation has many solutions. You know, waves that propagate with this momentum, waves that propagate with that momentum in that direction, are plenty of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And in fact, we're summing over all of them. We're summing over a collection of all of them. We're not summing over all of them. All of them would include a wave going this way, plus a wave going that way, plus a wave going this way. Right? That's a solution too. Any linear superposition of solutions is going to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So we're not summing over all of them. We're just summing over all those solutions that happen to be plane waves. In curved space-time, we cannot single out plane waves in this way. Because what is a plane wave on curved space-time anyway? There's no unique way to do that. It would be just like trying to draw a chessboard on curved space-time with everything right angles. It's just not possible. And so similarly, we can't have a canonical notion of plane waves on a curved space-time either. So let's be open-minded about this. All we are saying, all we are requiring is that for every choice of k, whatever the index set k is, could be R3, could be a lattice, but for every choice of k, u index k of x and t is supposed to be a solution to the Kein-Gordon equation. So now we seem to be already two-thirds done, because out of the three conditions, hermeticity condition, equation of motion, and canonical commutation relations, we seem to have already the hermeticity condition in the bag, and also the equations of motion. Because as long as we choose solutions of the equations of motion here, solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, the whole thing will solve the equations of motion. Now, how about the canonically conjugate momentum field? Well, we define it to be this, because that's what's needed for overall covariance. Remember, that's what came out at the end of the previous lecture, that the relationship between the canonical conjugate momentum field and the time derivative of phi is actually this complicated thing that generally also contains phase derivatives of phi. All right, so that's going to be our ansatz. Again, keep in mind, k labels solutions, but k doesn't generally label momentum. There isn't even such a thing as a momentum variable in curved space-time in general. Sometimes there is. In cosmology, there usually is, but not in general. So how about these A and A dagger operators? For every k, so for every solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, we have introduced a pair of operators, AK, AK dagger. And we are imposing, as usual, that these guys obey these commutation relations. Well, and as we said already, the uk of x and t, those mode functions, are still to be determined, but we already know we want them to be solutions to the equations of motion, to the Klein-Gordon equation. So these guys are called the mode functions. So let's try out our ansatz. Does it go through? First of all, hermeticity, yes, by construction, that's easy. The equation of motion, I mean, the first equation of motion is the Klein-Gordon equation. And the second equation of motion is the one that relates pi to phi dot. So the first equation of motion holds by assumption, because we choose our mode functions to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We are assuming here that we can solve the Klein-Gordon equation, which, of course, in practice could be super difficult. If you have the Klein-Gordon equation on some wildly expanding here, shrinking there space-time, it would be very difficult to do. But as a matter of principle, we know they're there. Okay, so the Klein-Gordon equation holds for the field phi hat because, as we said, these guys are constants, and the mode functions obey the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. The second equation of motion is defined by definition, is holding by definition, because we defined pi hat such that the second equation of motion is fulfilled, such that it has the covariant relationship to phi dot and the space derivatives of phi. Now, the difficult part, and by now we should be prepared for that, the difficult part is checking that the canonical commutation relations are fulfilled. Or not really, it's not just a matter of checking. We have to find out whether we can actually fulfill the canonical commutation relation. So what we need the ansatz to fulfill is these equal time commutation relations. And so logically, the problem is we need to find out what condition our choice of mode functions, uk, has to obey such that the canonical commutation relations hold. And then we have to find out whether that condition can be fulfilled. Can we actually find a set of mode functions, a set of complex number valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, u of x and t, such that the canonical commutation relations hold. So in other words, this condition implies a condition on the choice of mode functions. What is the condition and can it be fulfilled? So let us work out what that canonical commutator means in practice for our ansatz. So we write our phi in terms of the ansatz, in terms of the guess, that is to say. And then we also write the canonically conjugate momentum field, which is defined in this way, in terms of the ansatz, which is to say that in this expression here for pi, we replace phi by what it is supposed to be according to the ansatz. And that's what we get. So we obtain that the canonically conjugate momentum field is this expression here, which now involves derivatives of the mode functions. So the phi and pi that we have now expressed in terms of our ansatz now need to be commuted. So let's see what it means for the choice of mode functions that the canonical commutation relations have to hold. So the commutator turns out to be this long expression because the phi field by our ansatz is this thing, and then the pi field by the ansatz that would be right there is given by this long expression. So let's work out what this commutator is. What are we going to get? Well, there's going to be a commutator between annihilation operators and annihilation operators, but they commute with another, the eight daggers commute among another, and we are going to pick up terms when we have to commute the A with this A dagger and that A dagger with this A here. What are we going to get? We can pull this factor and this sum here and that sum out of the commutator. The whole thing is just linear. So we get a square root of G, the G is 0 nu, and the double sum over the K and the K prime. And then we have this term here, the UK of X prime and T. And it gives us a non-trivial commutator with that term here that has an A dagger. And it is D by dx nu U star. So D by dx nu U star. That's that term. And then we get an analogous term where we have that this doesn't commute with that because of the A dagger here and the A here. And we pick up this prefactor here. But because the A dagger is to the left of the commutator gives us a minus sign. So we get minus this. And both of these terms are proportional to the commutator between A and A dagger, which is the Kronecker delta of K and K prime, or if this is a continuous label, then it would be the Dirac delta of K and K prime. All right, so the commutator between phi and pi is this terrible expression. It's not easy to see how this expression could become what it should be, which is I times the Dirac delta of x minus x prime. But that's what we need here, right? So here we still have a double sum in k and k prime, but because of the commutator between A and A dagger, which produces a Dirac delta in k and k prime, one of these two sums goes away. Let's say the k prime sum because of this Kronecker delta. And therefore, this expression becomes simply this expression here with a simple sum and only k's occurring and no longer any k primes. So there we have it. With our ansatz, the commutator between phi and pi comes out to be this expression, which does depend on x and x prime. Here, the mode functions depend on x and x prime. So this one has the argument x prime, that one x, and here's x prime, here's x. The k is being summed over or integrated over, as the case may be. And so overall, this whole thing has an x and x prime dependence. And that x and x prime dependence better be I times h bar, but we're setting h bar equal to 1 here, I times Dirac delta of x minus x prime. From this requirement, we can see why, in our answers, we don't get away with just choosing one or two or just a few solutions.
Sorry?
Yeah?
I just wanted to confirm in your formula, you had derivatives with respect to x prime as opposed to with respect to x in the last formula on this page.
Oh, you mean here?
No, the one after this.
Oh, after that, okay. Yes. Oh, I mixed it up. That should not have a prime then. That's right. This cannot act on that one. That's right. Yeah, I'll go through that. Thanks. Right. So my point is, this equation needs to be fulfilled. We have to choose solutions uk of x and t. You have to choose mode functions such that this equation holds true. But let's remember how our ansatz looks like. This is our ansatz up here. And we said that if it wasn't for the canonical commutation relations, if all we needed was the hermeticity condition and the equations of motion, well, then that sum could be a finite sum. In fact, we could just take one solution here and be done with it. Right? One solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and we would be done, because then we have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation here, here the complex conjugate of it, the whole thing would obey the Klein-Gordon equation, and we would also have the hermeticity condition, because that's the Hermitian conjugate of that, so we'd be fine. But now we see, from the requirement that the canonical commutation relations also hold, we see that we don't get away with this. Why? Why do we have to take a sum, in fact, an infinite sum? Well, it's because this equation could never hold if there wasn't a sum. Because look at it. Imagine there was no sum. There was only one k value, only one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation that we employ. Then what would we have? We would have here a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which is not a Dirac delta. It's not going to be a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, times the derivative of something that's not a Dirac delta, some regular solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, minus similar stuff. That's not going to add up to a Dirac delta. See? These are all regular solutions. We need lots of them. In fact, infinitely many of them, to have a chance to get a distribution as their sum. One or just finitely many of them will never give us the Dirac delta here. Also notice that, curiously, there's no time dependence on the right-hand side. On the left, there seems to be one. So things really have to come together for our ansatz to work, right? It would seem like, well, good luck with that. Maybe this ansatz is not going to fly. But we'll see that it will fly. Just have to be very careful and rely on a few theorems. Yep?
Didn't we just pick one solution, but then make the commutation relations for A and A dagger be such that they fulfill that?
You would have to use commutation relations between the A and A dagger that have space and time dependence in order to do that. And then you would just end up doing the same thing, just with time and space dependence absorbed in the A and A dagger.
But if we had decided to keep the time dependence in the A and A daggers, maybe here it wouldn't seem on the left hand side that we have time dependence. Right?
Well, as I said, yes, you can do this. But then there's a kind of no free lunch theorems kicking in. And you would just have to, you would find that you get then that the A and A daggers have to obey non-trivial equations of motion. And I mean, non-trivial dynamical equations, which boil down to having to solve this.
More natural in the Heisenberg picture that they satisfy some equations of motion, and you know, they're not just constants.
Yeah, some authors take that view. You could do that. You could put all of your time dependence into the A and A daggers. But conceptually, I'd just like to separate the two issues and say that, yes, we work in the Heisenberg picture, and therefore the phi and the pi have to be time dependent, of course. But I'm viewing the A and A daggers not as observables. No, they're not observables, but merely as mathematical tools to help us solve the equation. And keep in mind, too, that as we discussed earlier, the ANA daggers are often called annihilation and creation operators. But they only annihilate, they only create excitations when applied to Fock vectors. For generic vectors, they don't. For example, if you apply the A operator, the supposed annihilation operator, on a coherent state, well, the coherent state is an eigenvector to it. So it doesn't change at all. In particular, the number expectation doesn't change. So the annihilation operator isn't an operator that is of physical significance directly. It's not an observable, and it's also not generally creating or annihilating particles. It's just a mathematical tool. And so I keep it on the tool side, you know, just a tool to obey the canonic commutation relations. And then all of the dynamics is on the functions. And we can mix it. We can have operators that are non-commutative and have non-trivial time dependence, but I find it conceptually easier to separate the two tasks, as long as we can do it. There could be more complicated theories where it may be unavoidable to try to solve both at once. But here we can still do it. We can still cleanly solve the equations of motion independently of solving for the canonical commutation relations. Okay, so this is the condition that needs to be fulfilled. No matter what time, the right-hand side needs to be a distribution in the distance in the space. It doesn't look like we could do it, right? So we need solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that for any time combine in such a way that we get the Kronecker delta here. Let's see if there's some theorem that can help us. Oh, I just have another slide or two on summarizing where we are now. Okay, so where we are now is this. We made this ansatz for the field, that it is some sum. I don't know why I changed it to n and then dropped the n. Anyway, so this is our ansatz. It solves automatically the three conditions, Hermiticity condition, equation of motion, and commutation relations, if we can find a set of complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that this particularly complicated-looking condition here is obeyed. Just the same equation that we had a slide about. I'm calling that equation W because you may remember having seen such an expression before, namely in the theory of partial differential equations. This is what is called a Wronskian. And if you've seen a Wronskian before, you know that Wronskians are conserved in time. And I'm just speaking to those who may have seen these things before. that's very useful because the conservation of the Wronskian will mean that the right-hand side is not time-dependent, which is what we need. You may wonder, what is the physical interpretation of there being something that's conserved? That there's something that's conserved in time. Remember, we're dealing here with a theory that doesn't have symmetries, because we allow here the space-time to be pretty generic. It could have curvature here and there and expand and shrink and all of that. No killing vector fields, no conservation laws per se. And yet, here we have something that seems to be time-dependent, but isn't, if we get away with it, right? So what is it that's conserved here? What's the underlying symmetry behind this? And it turns out that the underlying symmetry, in quotation marks, is not the usual kind of symmetry, but it's still an important one. It's the symmetry of quantum theory under unitary transformation. You can always just do a unitary transformation on the Hilbert space and not change anything. You can represent your theory in any basis you want. And you may wonder, okay, that's a pretty big symmetry for an n-dimensional Hilbert space. That's a UN, unitary group UN. What's conserved because of it? I mean, by Noether's theorem, you have a symmetry, you get something conserved. Well, the conservation law that corresponds to that symmetry is the conservation of the canonical commutation relations. It's not something like conservation of energy, but it's more important. Because conservation of energy we won't have on curved space-time, because there's no time translation invariance. But we will have conservation of the canonical commutation relations. We will have that we can represent our theory in whatever basis in Hilbert space we want. But from the perspective of partial differential equations, such as the Klein-Gordon equation, this boils down to the fact that the so-called Wronskian among solutions of a partial differential equation of a particular type is conserved. Anyway, that's just a preview and comment. We'll do it carefully. So our answers will succeed if we can find a bunch of solutions. In fact, we expect that we need infinitely many of those, such that this expression in terms of the derivatives and the solutions themselves ends up being I h bar Dirac delta. Okay, so here at this point we need to make some assumptions. Let's assume that space-time is what is called globally hyperbolic, which is to say that it possesses a foliation by Cauchy surfaces so that we see that it's topologically of the form of a time variable, which is just R or a subset of R. Could be a Big Bang theory in which time starts. So it doesn't have to be the entire real axis, but it is just some stretch of the real line, Kronecker delta with a Cartesian product with some three-dimensional differentiable manifold. But let's assume that our space-time takes that form. In this case, space-time cannot possess any closed time-like curves, so there's no travel into the past. And in particular, initial conditions set on any one of those Cauchy surfaces, which is to say, at any one of those instances of equal time, determine the solution everywhere. So we are making the assumption here that we can foliate, that we can, roughly speaking, introduce a coordinate system in which for every fixed value of time, the space you get is a space-like hypersurface on which you can fix initial conditions, and that will determine the solution everywhere. So we are just assuming that the initial value problem is well defined. Then one can show that our answers will succeed, namely that there will be a bunch of solutions, infinitely many of them, of the Klein-Gordon equation, complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that the Wronskian condition is fulfilled. There's only one problem, which is that we get more than we were bargaining for. It will turn out that not only do we get a bunch of solutions that, when plugged into our ansatz, solve all of the requirements. Ooh, not unique. We get infinitely many of them. I'm not saying we get infinitely many solutions. No, we get infinitely many sets of solutions. There are infinitely many choices for what we can choose, infinitely many families of solutions, so that we can solve the problem. So our answer succeeds very well. There are many, many, many families of UKs that we can use.
Do the different solutions describe different physics?
Yeah. No, they describe the same physics. But it's a subtler thing. It has to do with which state is the vacuum state. In principle, you can describe the same physics with any one of those solutions. But one choice will be preferred generally. No, I should say that in many physically relevant situations, we can identify a vacuum state. And then there will be a preferred choice of family of solutions such that the associated A and A dagger operators have the property that the A operators annihilate what we previously identified as the vacuum state. We can also use the other ones. All of these choices just differ by a unitary transformation. So either by a unitary transformation on the field or a unitary transformation on the state. And for convenience, whenever we can identify which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state, we will choose the family of solutions in such a way that the A operators annihilate that state. For cosmology, that's good enough. But in generic curved spacetimes, where let's say some part of it is expanding, some other part is shrinking, all at the same time, it is just not possible to define a vacuum state. There probably is no observer, no coordinate system with respect to which there are no particles. Even among all states, right? So you can use a vacuum cleaner no matter how much you suck away the particles, the space-time is generating them. It's just no way of having a proper vacuum state. In fact, even in the case that we have vacuum states, they are typically not unique. For example, for a curved space-time, I'm anticipating stuff that we will do in great detail later on. But in a curved space-time, you could imagine, for example, starting out with a Minkowski space. The universe is not expanding, it's just sitting there. And then an expansion kicks in. Stuff happens. And then after a while, it coasts again, it's just Minkowski space. So overall, that would be a cosmology in which we start with Minkowski space, we have an expansion, and then we have Minkowski space again. In this case, we typically have that in the initial Minkowski space, we can identify which state would be the vacuum state then. During the expansion, what state in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state can change because stuff is happening. There's an expansion that is behaving non-trivially. And then at the end, we have Minkowski space again, and we can identify again what is the vacuum state just from knowing how Minkowski space looks like. We know quantum field theory Minkowski space very well. So what do we do if we have several good candidates for vacuum states? Early Minkowski, then while the expansion is happening, and then again late Minkowski, for example. Well, we'll do what we did when we discussed the driven harmonic oscillator. There was an in ground state, there was an out ground state, and they're related by Bogoliubov transformations. And in this way, we were able to describe the excitation of a harmonic oscillator due to a driving force. Now, doing this for quantum fields, we will be able to identify not the excitation of a driven harmonic oscillator, but we will identify the excitation of the mode oscillators of quantum fields. So we will identify how the expansion of space-time creates particles. Just because the late vacuum state is not the early vacuum state. But in the Heisenberg picture, the early vacuum state stays the state of the field forever. But the operators move on. And so if at the later stage, the vacuum state is a different state from what it was earlier, well, then the interpretation of what state the system is in, which is the in state, in vacuum state, is a state with particles. All right, so we will spend quite a bit of time on choosing those appropriately and identifying what the vacuum state is. Okay, so the point I wanted to make is that we will show now that there always exists such solutions, such families of solutions, such that our ansatz goes through. But, well, there can be many families of such solutions. Now let's prove this. That's going to be a little bit technical. But I think it should be done at least once. Actually, most papers and textbooks are rather brief or cryptic, or they just don't do it. So, but I thought it's important to do this at least once, because after all, if we want to go beyond what we know about quantum field theory and curved spacetimes, we need to know the inner machinery that's going on there. So let's consider all of the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So that means, I mean, classical solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, just number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. But complex-valued ones, right? Because we need to be open-minded about the complex-valuedness. That means we're looking at solutions where it's a plane wave in this direction, a plane wave in that direction, plane waves in any direction, plus linear combinations of them, where we have simultaneously waves going that way and that way and that way, and solutions where we have infinitely many of plane waves superimposed, all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. For example, superimposed to give us wave packets. So we're looking now at the vector space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. This is quite different from what we are used to. Remember, now we're doing, for technical reasons, not for physical reasons, but for technical reasons because of the way we try to solve the quantum field theory. We are looking now not at a function space per se, like the square integrable functions on R3. No, now we are looking at a function space of a different kind. It's the space of functions which solve a particular equation. Right? So we're looking at the space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. That is, in fact, a linear vector space, because this linear combination of any two solutions happens to be a solution again. Wouldn't work if we had an interaction term, if we had something like a phi to the fourth theorem, phi to the fourth term in the Hamiltonian, then clearly the sum of two solutions is generally not a solution. But we're just looking at the free Klein-Gordon field on a curved space-time background, and there the linear combination of two solutions is a solution. Therefore, the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation is actually a vector space. And let us start with just the real valued solutions, and we will upgrade that to complex valued solutions in a moment. So let's say we consider the space V, the vector space V of all real valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Then let us define an inner product, or just let's just say a product between any two such solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And we denote it here with these round brackets. So this product is going to be such that you can plug in two real-valued solutions. Remember, V only contains solutions, not arbitrary functions, only solutions. So we are considering a product where you can plug in two solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and you get out a number, a real number. And it's going to be calculated in this way. It's going to be the integrate and the integral over a space-like hypersurface. So you choose a coordinate system, and then you choose a time. And then for fixed time, space is a space-like hypersurface, and we integrate over that. So this is a three-dimensional integral over equal time surface. And then what we're integrating is the square root of g, g mu, and then f and h differentiated in this way. That should remind you of the Wronskian equation. It's not that exactly, but we will get there. So we are defining this number. You take two solutions for the Klein-Gordon equation, integrate this way, where if you're not familiar with it, this sigma mu is a time-like vector that's pointing orthogonal to this three-dimensional space-like hypersurface. So for example, if you choose a coordinate system, and then this integral is over as the space at equal time, then this is going to be a vector that only has a non-zero zero component and not spatial component. Basically, what that means is that it will pick out the coefficients g0 nu in this case. So in practice, that's how we would integrate it. Then the claim is, a claim is, that this inner product, this product between two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, this real number that we get out of this calculation, for any pair of solutions is independent of the time. It's independent of the time that we calculate it in. You see, f is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, so it's f is a function of space and time. H is a function of space and time. Therefore, I mean, square root of g is a function of space and time. So is this, the metric is a function of space and time. All of these terms are functions of space and time. And then we're integrating over all of space at one point in time that we pick. And the claim is, it doesn't matter what time we pick. It's the same thing. It's a conserved quantity. It is the Wronskian of the Klein-Gordon equation. Not exactly the complex Wronskian that we need for our quantum field theory, but we get to that in a moment. So for the Klein-Gordon equation on curved space-time, that is a conserved quantity. For now, it's just a proposition. Later in the course, I think in the next lecture, we will prove it using Stokes' theorem and the Klein-Gordon equation. We will prove that this really is a constant in time. But for now, just take my word for it, it's really a constant. Yeah?
Can you define such a quantity for any field theory or just the Klein-Gordon?
Not any. I can't give you the exact conditions for it now, but not any, no. Now, that product between two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, not only is it constant in time, which is a curious phenomenon, right? Just take two functions of time, plug the number in, and you can evaluate it anytime you want. You get the same number out of it. This thing is also called a symplectic form. It is anti-symmetric. I mean, it's obviously anti-symmetric, because if you exchange f and h, well, then, you know, this term becomes that term and vice versa, so it's just a minus. So it has this anti-symmetry, it's a symplectic form. And what can we do with this? See, when we have a product between two vectors in a vector space, then in quantum mechanics, instinctively, we hope that this inner product is like the inner product in a Hilbert space, and that we basically have a self-adjoint operator that we can diagonalize. But this symplectic form is clearly some kind of matrix, but it's an anti-symmetric matrix. And an anti-symmetric matrix, we can't just apply the spectral theorem to. However, there is a theorem that plays a similar role to the spectral theorem for anti-symmetric matrices, for symplectic forms. And what it says is, the theorem is by Dabou, what it says is that any non-degenerate symplectic form, so we don't want it to have any, you know, big space that it annihilates. So for any non-degenerate symplectic form, there exists a choice of bases in the vector space V such that in this basis, our symplectic form takes this particular shape. So it consists of little 2x2 blocks, and each 2x2 block has entries 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and so on, and the rest is all zeros. There are no eigenvalues to be determined or anything. You can always choose a basis that, such that it takes this particular form. And that means that if we enumerate our basis vectors by integers, then the product of the symplectic form evaluated for basis vectors V2n and V2n plus 1 is 1, because then we are picking up these guys. Right? So, for example, n could be 0, and then that would be 1. So it would be the inner product between the v0 and the v1 vector. And that would be this one that we pick up in this case. And then, on the other hand, if we calculate the a symplectic form for entry is v to n plus 1, so it's an odd number and an even number, then we get a minus 1, so we're picking up those minus 1s here. And all the other pairings vanish. We take any other two basis vectors out of one of those taboo bases. If we take any other two basis vectors, they are not going to have a finite value of their symplectic form. Their product is going to be zero because we are somewhere here in that matrix. Okay, so we have a space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And we have a product in that space of solutions, which is a symplectic form. Then with respect, and that, we chose that symplectic form because it has the special property that its values are conserved in time. So that makes it very special. And then with respect to that symplectic form, we choose a basis. We know by Darboux's theorem that there's going to be a Darboux basis. In fact, later we will see there's going to be many Darboux bases. It's not like a self-adjoint operator, which by the spectral theorem has a unique basis up to phase. Darboux's theorem gives us plenty of bases, as we will see. But for now, the only thing that matters is that, yes, there are bases such as that. So we pick one of those bases, and we call those basis vectors vn, label them by positive integers. And then these are the products of these basis vectors. And if you express it as a matrix, it looks like this. OK, so now every solution out to the Klein-Gordon equation, that is to say every vector, A in the vector space V, B in the vector space V, is a linear combination of our basis vectors. So any vector A, any solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, is some linear combination of these basis vectors. And similarly for B. And then the symplectic form evaluated for two arbitrary solutions can be written in our Darboux basis as the sum of these coefficients here, you know, these expansion coefficients, A2n, 2n plus 1, minus these. So once we've chosen a basis, and it's convenient to choose a Darboux basis, we can evaluate the inner product now between two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, no longer by calculating those integrals over the, I mean, here it is. You don't have to calculate the symplectic form this way. No, if we know f and h expanded in a Darboux basis, if we know their coefficients in a Darboux basis, then we can calculate the inner product, the symplectic product, also in this way directly from the coefficients. Okay? Just another way of writing things. OK, so let's assume now that we've picked such a Darboux basis, Vn. Remember, V is the space of real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, let's define the complexified space. So V bar is now a larger vector space. V bar is defined to be the space of complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. It's, of course, very easily obtained, right? Because you can just take any solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, real-valued solution, plus I times another real-valued solution, you get a complex-valued solution. And this is how you get all of the complex-valued solutions, because the Klein-Gordon equation doesn't mix real and imaginary parts. It's just linear combinations of another. So the whole thing goes through very trivially because it's linear. So if V bar is the space of complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then let's look for a basis in it. Now, we already have a Darboux basis of V. And we know it has special properties. It's in the Darboux basis, the symplectic product takes a particularly simple form. So let us define now a basis for V bar. And these basis vectors we will call un and un star. And the un are obtained as 1 over square root of 2, and then this linear combination of real-valued solutions. And the un star are that linear combination of real-valued solutions. Both of them are complex-valued solutions here. So clearly, since the v are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, the u and the u star are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And clearly, you can, if you know the un and the un star, you can calculate what the vn are and vice versa. So you're not losing any information, and you can easily convince yourself that the un and the un star together really span v bar, given that the v span the big space, span the space big V of real-valued solutions. The u and the u star will span the space of complex-valued solutions. So that's straightforward. Then let us ask, how does the symplectic form for the V solutions, for the real-valued solutions, how does it translate into something like a symplectic form? I mean, whatever it becomes then, for the un and the un star. What do we know about, I mean, what can we define, what kind of product can we define between the un and the un star based on the symplectic form? So what we can do is, on v star, we define this product, where we use angled brackets now. But these are not the Hilbert space angled brackets at all. Nothing to do with them. I just chose the angled bracket to make sure that we are not mixing it up with the round brackets of the symplectic form. Now, let's just define this for now. And you see, it's almost the same as what we defined as the symplectic form for two real-valued solutions, except that we also have complex conjugation in here now. So here we have a complex conjugate, complex conjugate. Then, knowing what the symplectic form did, we can work out what this is for any pair of f and g, f and h, if they are complex valued solutions, and in particular, if they are un and um. And what we find is that the product, now the angled product, between these basis vectors of the complex solutions is this. The angle product between the un and the um is actually a Kronecker delta of n and m with a minus sign. And the starred ones have a plus sign here. And they are kind of orthogonal if you take a u here and a u star there. I didn't want to go through the details of this calculation. It's just plug it in, and it's just linear algebra.
Why do you say they're kind of orthogonal?
Because in order to define orthogonality, you need a Hilbert space inner product, which we didn't define. But it almost looks like that, right? There's only one problem here. It almost looks like a Hilbert space, right? I mean, this part looks like a Hilbert space.
Right.
Because these guys, you know, it just look like orthogonal and normalized. Except that these guys have a minus one here. That's not so good. And other than that, yeah, it looks like orthogonal. So if we choose our basis now to be the un and the un star, then this angled product is an indefinite inner product on V star. Indefinite because, well, yeah, it can go negative. It's an indefinite inner product on V bar, and it takes this form. That's the inner product on that space. It's a bit like in relativity where you have the metric. And it's also an indefinite inner product because lengths can come out negative because of minus signs and plus signs occurring in its diagonalization. Now, what we can prove, though, is that there is a resolution of the identity in that vector space V bar, given in the following way. The identity can be written as the sum over, and then here you have formally Bras and Ketz, but remember, that's not Hilbert space Bras and Ketz of the quantum theory. This is just with regards to that inner product, this angled inner product over there, right? So you take these UNs and their Ketz and Bras, and then also the stars, and here you have a minus one. That's unusual. That wouldn't be the usual case in Hilbert space theory. And here you have a plus one, but you get a resolution of the identity. So that is convenient because it means you can now represent everything in that space of complex solutions as linear combinations of these UN and UN stars in a straightforward way. It turns out that we are very close to, actually you can prove this using Hilbert space theory and the spectral theorem. But I didn't want to go too much into that. Let me just tell you that one can turn V bar, the space of complex solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, into a Hilbert space, into an actual Hilbert space with a positive definite inner product. And that is called the Krein space. I wrote it here in black because I thought I'd save time by going over that step quickly, but in any case. So you define operators P plus and P minus to be projectors onto the spaces spanned by the starred solutions and by the unstarred solutions. You know, we have these basis vectors in the complex vector space V bar. And there is part of it is spanned by the starred solution and part of it by the unstarred ones. And we project on either the one or the other. And then you can define the inner product, which is actually a Hilbert space inner product of two complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. And I write that with a double angled thing because it's yet a different inner product. That is, by definition, the single angled inner product, the indefinite inner product between F and G, but with a projector P plus in the middle minus F and G with a projector P minus in the middle. It turns out that this little trick here turns it around and everything's positive definite. And once you have a Hilbert space, you can then define resolutions of the identity as usual. And prove in particular this part. In fact, we can prove it right away. We have it here. No, yeah, we did all the legwork for that earlier. Okay, so here's the resolution of the identity, and with a single angled bracket. And let's see, all we have to show in order to prove that this is a resolution of the identity is that when we apply it to any one of the basis vectors, we get back the basis vector. So let's apply this identity written in this way. Let's apply it to the UN. Well, for that purpose, we have to apply this thing on the UN, and we have to apply that thing on the UN. Now, all of these guys are formally orthogonal in the sense that they have vanishing indefinite inner product with our UN, so this is not going to contribute. This one will have a non-zero inner product if the n here coincides with the n over there, but with a minus sign. So therefore, that minus sign combines with this minus sign, we get the identity here. And similarly, we can show that it acts as the identity on these basis vectors as well. Okay, fine. So therefore, for any complex-valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, we have that we can write the complex-valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation in this way. Here's F, the complex-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and here we are applying the identity, the resolution of the identity on F. Right? We're just applying, here it is, we're applying this expression on F. Okay. Why would we want to do this? It turns out that this equation is effectively the Wronskian condition. It's effectively what we needed to make our ansatz to solve the quantum field theory in curved space-time work. Remember, hermeticity was easy, equation of motion was easy, but the canonical commutation relations were only obeyed if the Wronskian condition held. And it turns out that this equation here is effectively the Wronskian condition. Here's how we see that. So what we have to show is that this equation is basically that equation. Well, we will write this out explicitly, and then we will do a functional derivative with respect to f to get rid of the f, and then what we see is that what we're left with is basically the resolution of the identity. So what I'm saying is that the resolution of the identity is basically this. The Wronskian condition is simply saying that you can use a Dabou basis of the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation to get a resolution of the identity in the space of solutions. And that's what we'll show now. OK, so remember, this was the indefinite inner product on the space of complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. It is with the complex conjugation in there. Now, if we choose the coordinate system, then this becomes an integration over R3, just the spatial variables, at equal time. We pick an arbitrary time. Let's call it T0. Remember, it doesn't matter when. We will later prove that it doesn't matter when you do this. So we pick up time T0, then we integrate over all of space. This sigma mu becomes a time-like vector with components 1, 0, 0, 0. And therefore, we just have here g0 nu, because that contracted with this gives us a g0 nu. Square root of g here, and that's what we have to integrate. Where all of these things depend on our choice of time, t0, when our choice of time when we do that slicing. OK, now equation p was the resolution of the identity applied to f. So here's the resolution of the identity applied to f. And if we now use the explicit formulation of the angled bracket of the indefinite inner product on complex solutions, if we use that particular expression on this equation here, the resolution of the identity, then we obtain that the resolution of the identity takes this form. Lots of terms. Oh, maybe I should show you a little bit more in order to see the connection here. OK, so what we have is un. Here's the un. But now it's a un of x and t. So it's a solution, right? And then here we have the indefinite inner product between this Dabou basis solution and that arbitrary solution. And here we have that inner product between the Dabou basis solution and the arbitrary complex solution f. And then here we have the same thing, but here we have the un star, and here is this inner product. And remember that inner product is evaluated at some point in time t0. It doesn't matter, though, at what time you do that. But still, these integrals here are evaluated at some point in time t0. Now, let's interchange the summation and the integration here, the integration over the space of a space and the summation over the family of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Now we have the integral outside, and we have the sum inside. And we have all of those terms here, just collected everything together. And also we have this arbitrary solution f, complex solution here on this side. Remember, this all depends on t0. because we have to evaluate that inner product, that indefinite inner product, at some point in time. So the solution here is evaluated at t naught, evaluated at t naught, evaluated at t naught. Okay, so that's what the notice is saying. On the left-hand side of this equation, f is evaluated for all x prime, but only at one time, t naught. Now, let us choose an arbitrary function g of x prime. Let me tell you where we are going with this. We want to show that this equation here, which we know holds, it's just the resolution of the identity in the space of solutions. This equation here we want to massage and put it in the form of the Wronskian condition so that we can conclude that because there's a resolution of the identity in that solution space, the Wronskian condition can be fulfilled. Namely, what we have to choose as our family of solutions to be put in our ansatz is a double basis. Right? That's the overall thing about what we want to do. We're almost there. So we've shown that the resolution of the identity expressed explicitly in the indefinite inner product is this equation here. And here we have still a time dependence sitting there. But here we have that this depends on t naught. So let us now choose an arbitrary function g of x prime. Then there exists a solution f of x prime and t of the Klein-Gordon equation, which has the property that our solution f of x prime at the time t naught is the function g that we arbitrarily picked. So we choose an arbitrary function to generate a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, namely by saying that we want that at time t naught, the time where we evaluated the indefinite inner product, at time t naught, the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation is having these amplitudes of our arbitrarily chosen function. And what's derivative? Remember, the Klein-Gordon equation is second order. We need to impose two initial conditions to fix what it will do next. So we choose the amplitude to be this, and the time and time and space derivatives, but basically it's the time generalized time derivative applied on f to be zero. We can impose both of these and still solve the problem, and we get a uniquely a solution then of the Klein-Gordon equation out of this. That's where it enters, that we had, that we assumed that we have a well-defined Cauchy problem for every point in time, that our space-time is globally hyperbolic. So then, equation star. Here we go. That's our resolution of the identity. Then gives us, for all choices of g, so now we replace f by the g of x. I mean, if we just use these equations here, f of x prime and t naught is g of x prime here. We plug that in here, and we find that for whatever we choose for g of x, the resolution of the identity equation that we had above takes this simple form, where two terms, by the way, dropped out. If you remember, there were four terms up there. Yeah? One, two, three, and four. And two of them dropped out because we choose our initial conditions in such a way, which is something we can afford to do because it's a second order equation. We can impose two conditions. So what we then obtain is that the resolution of the identity equation in terms of the double of a double basis is this equation here, which holds for all functions g of x. If we now functionally differentiate that equation with respect to g, then here we get rid of the g and rid of the integral, and here we get a Dirac delta. So overall, we obtain that this equation holds. So what we've shown is that because the space of solutions of real-valued solutions has a symplectic form. This has a Darboux basis, which is also a Darboux basis for the complex, for the space of complex solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And this Darboux basis can be used to write down a resolution of the identity in that space. Then we wrote down the resolution of the identity explicitly. And when you write it down explicitly, you find that for any Darboux basis, this equation holds. That is the resolution of the identity. But this is also the equation W. This is the equation that needed to hold for our ansatz to go through and the canonical commutation relations also to hold. One thing to notice here is that in all of these things that we did today, in principle, the space of solutions was always a linear space. You take a solution, you add another solution to it, then that's still a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, right? And it doesn't disturb hermeticity, doesn't disturb the equations of motion to take linear combinations of them. But again, the canonical commutation relations are different. If you take a Darboux basis, this equation will hold. But now, if you multiply one of those vectors by some number, you still get a solution. They're all just solutions. But that will screw up that equation, because you have the u on the left-hand side, but not on the right-hand side. This is a nonlinear equation for the u. So you can also view this as a normalization condition on the u. What that means is that when we wrote down our ansatz for solving the quantum field theory on curved space-time, we wrote down these mode functions times the A and A dagger operators. And all we said is, we require these mode functions to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Yes, but now we see they also have to have a particular normalization. They have to be multiplied with the right prefactor. Can't just take the solutions and multiply them with whatever number you want. You have to have them orthogonal in the Darboux basis. Not just orthonormal in the Darboux basis. And so in this Quine space, they have to be properly orthonormalized. And then we have that this holds. This is important because it means that the mode functions come with very specific prefactors. They're only ambiguous at most by a phase. But even that, in principle, is fixed in here. And that prefactor can also be dimension dependent, and we will get to these things. Okay, so let me just wrap up with the conclusion so far. We have that the canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity conditions, and the equations of motion can be always fulfilled for globally hyperbolic spacetimes with the following ansatz. The quantum field is given in this way as a sum of mode functions times the A and A dagger, where by mode function we mean any complex-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And the pi are just given by construction to fulfill the relevant equation of motion. If, and that's an extra condition that we've now uncovered, if the family of solutions is such that it obeys this condition. And it looks terribly difficult to fulfill that condition, but we know it's always possible, and we know what it means to have a family of solutions that does the trick. Namely, what we have uncovered, if we find the family of solutions that does it, is that we found a complex Darboux basis. And so in principle, we know what to do. We take a matrix, we take this matrix representation of the symplectic form, and we need to find a basis in the space such that it takes this canonical form of these little 2x2 boxes on the diagonal. And once we have that, then we can write down a Darboux basis for the complex solutions, and then we are guaranteed to solve that equation here. So what do we need to do next then? Well, we showed that the Wronskian condition ensures that the canonical commutation relations hold at one time. What guarantees conservation of the canonical commutation relations? Well, we will prove I mean, it's a property of the differential equation. And in order to prove it directly, though, using Stokes' theorem and unitarity. And then we'll have to address whether the question whether these taboo bases are unique. And the answer is no. And it's interesting that they're not unique. It's not a bug, it's a feature, because that the non-uniqueness of taboo bases is ultimately the reason why space-time can create particles. And because it's ultimately the reason for why what is the vacuum state now may not be the vacuum state later. There are Bogoliubov transformations between the various taboo bases, between the various A and A dagger operators. The A and A dagger operators of one taboo basis are not the same as the A and A dagger operators of the other taboo basis, just like for the driven harmonic oscillator. There was an A in operator, A dagger in operator, and an A out, A dagger out operator, related by Bogoliubov transformations and particle creation or excitation, at least, of the harmonic oscillators. The same thing happens here. And what it will mean is the ambiguity of the vacuum state. And by ambiguity, I don't mean to say we don't know what it is. What I mean to say is that what is the vacuum state at one time is not necessarily the vacuum state at another time. And you will also see that what is the vacuum state for one observer may not be the vacuum state for another observer, as we've seen already with the Andrew effect to some extent. OK, well, today was a little technical. I hope you survived it well. OK, any questions? OK, see you on Friday then.